Today I'm reading a sermon by Angela Herrera. It was originally given in March of this year at the First UU Church in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and it's slightly adapted for our purposes today. I'm going to tell you a story, a somewhat long story. It has some sad parts in it, but hang in there with me. It's a good one. You're going to remember it for a long time. Once upon a time, actually in 1990, there was a guy named B.J. Miller, who was a student at Princeton. He was a sophomore majoring in foreign relations and dreaming of one day working in China. When he wasn't studying, he sometimes did the things college students are rather notorious for in our country, like going out drinking on a weeknight. It was a Monday night when he and his friends went out and something happened that could never be undone. It would change the course of his life and eventually the course of other people's lives too. Miller and his friends had been drinking for hours when around 4 a.m. they got the munchies and left the bar to hit an all-night convenience store for some sandwiches. While they were out, they noticed a commuter train parked nearby and decided to climb it just for kicks. Miller went first. He doesn't remember what happened next, but his friends saw it. It happened just as soon as he got to the top of the train, a current of electricity arcing from the train's rooftop equipment over to the watch on his left wrist and through his body, down his legs, and out his feet. When his friends reached him, and I shudder to think of them scrambling up near the same piece of electrically charged equipment, but when his friends reached him, his feet were smoking. He woke up several days later, totally out of it, at the St. Barnabas Medical Center in Livingston, New Jersey. Thinking he was dreaming, Miller climbed out of bed and tried to walk across the room on those badly destroyed feet. His catheter got yanked out, and that's when the pain hit him. In the following days, doctors amputated both his legs below the knee. The day they scheduled the amputation of his arm, that was the worst. His doctors still weren't sure he was even going to survive, but he didn't know that. He was concerned with what kind of life he'd have, about whether he'd still be himself, or who he would be. Miller explains, hands do stuff. Your foot is just a stinky, clunky little platform. He hadn't been able to have visitors because the burn unit was a sterile environment. But the day of his arm's amputation, a group of friends and family, about a dozen of them, lie in the hallway as he was wheeled through to surgery, just to catch a glimpse of him, to let him know they were there, that they cared. Their presence made an impression on him. He feared that he was unlovable just then. He had made what seemed to all the world like a really stupid mistake. It was costing him so much. It was costing them, too. He wasn't going to be able to fix it. But here they are, he remembers thinking, proving I am lovable even when I can't see it. On his way out of surgery, he opened his eyes and saw his mother. She had caught polio as a child and had been in a wheelchair ever since. Mom, he told her as he passed by, now you and me have more in common. If this sounds like a really positive reaction to his situation, Miller is quick to say that he was definitely not in a good mental space. Not only that, his hospital room was windowless. One day he heard there was a blizzard outside. Knowing he couldn't see it deepened his sense of isolation. But he was at least open to finding whatever he could to grasp onto for hope. When a nurse sneaked a snowball into the antiseptic unit, he held it as it melted. He allowed himself to experience a sense of awe that he was part of a universe with snowballs in it. In a TED talk he would deliver years later, he described it as a moment of rapture. Rapture, joy, enthusiasm, a feeling of being transported. He experienced rapture along with everything else he was feeling. It was something. When he was released from the hospital, it took about a year before he was able to return to school. With two prosthetic legs and a prosthetic arm, he got around campus in a golf cart with a poorly behaved service dog by his side. Miller switched his major from foreign relations to art history, a major notorious for inspiring dread in parents of college students. What kind of job can you get with a degree in art history? But it helped. In dark lecture halls, Miller and his classmates looked at slides of ancient sculptures. I'll bet you can picture one in your mind, even if you've never taken an art history class. Got an image of an ancient sculpture in mind? Famous among humanity, the sculptures were monumental, beautiful, moving. And most of them were missing noses, arms, legs, ears. They were all very chipped and worn. The damage time had inflicted on the statues, these wounds they had acquired in the course of their lives, were considered part of their profound beauty now. I'll bet when you pictured one, some damage was part of the image you saw in your mind. The statues are revered as perfect art, yet no one living today has ever seen them whole. Miller saw himself in the statues' changed forms. They were fellow amputees. He observed that Western medicine does not see bodies the way art does. From the perspective of Western medicine, Miller says, there was an aberrant moment in your life, and with some help, you could get back to what you were or approximate it. Medicine uses words like disability and rehabilitation to describe a fallen or lesser state and its treatment. In reality, we are all on a continuum of ability. We were born with different levels of ability. As we age, we naturally move toward the less abled end. Some of us lose ability along the way due to injury or illness. We can even lose ability due to changing social conditions, like the invention of the printing press. Dyslexia was not a disability before people began to rely on written text. We acquire scars and stretch marks and wrinkles. Some of us have bionic parts, new knees, new hips. No one is entitled and no one can expect to stay in an optimally able, unscarred state. Miller decided to take a different approach to his injuries. In an article in New York Times Magazine, the journalist John Mualem, explains Miller's thinking at the time. Miller refused, for example, to let himself believe that his life was extra difficult now, only uniquely difficult, as all lives are. He resolved to think of his suffering as simply a variation on a theme we all deal with. To be human is really hard. Miller says, as a disabled person, he was getting all kinds of signals that he was different and separated from everyone else. But he worked hard to see himself as merely sitting somewhere on a continuum between the man on his deathbed and the woman who misplaced her car keys. To let his accident heighten his connectedness to others instead of isolating him. This was the only way, he thought, to keep from hating his injuries and by extension himself. It wouldn't be easy. Just like the day he told his mom they now had more in common, Miller still struggled with frustration, fear, and self-consciousness. The scars at the ends of his amputated limbs made the flesh look brutalized. At first, he didn't want anyone to see it. But he gradually went from the usual sock-like covering doctors offer amputees to actual socks, plain socks at first, then happier socks with bright patterns, until one day he gave up the socks altogether. Next, the ugly foam coverings came off his prosthetic limbs. He decided to let the strength and design of his prosthetic limbs be seen. Eventually, Miller was accepted into medical school. What a different perspective he must have brought to his classes. He found his way into palliative care, a specialty in which providers focus on improving the quality of life for people with serious illness. Miller went on to become the executive director of Zen Hospice in San Francisco. Zen Hospice started out as a pretty improvised response to the AIDS crisis in the 1980s. A group of Buddhists taking in young gay men who had nowhere else to go and trying to help them die more comfortably. Today, Zen Hospice is a thought leader in the end-of-life care, encouraging Western medicine and all of us to see death as a part of life. Part of being human, and not just a medical event, or worse, a medical failure. At Zen Hospice, patients are people. They can come and go, eat cookies, drink Bud Light, or smoke cigarettes if that's their thing. I love the fact that Miller survived, thrived, and went on to help people who are dying experience an abundance of life in their last days. I guess that's what kind of job you can get with an art history degree. Around that time, Miller also decided to take up motorcycle riding. He had already been mountain biking, but was drawn to the exhilarating speed of motorcycles. I guess that being a triple amputee probably slows you down when you're walking from place to place, going upstairs, carrying things and all that. Imagine the freedom of hopping on a motorcycle and propelling yourself down the road at 70 or 80 or 90 miles per hour. This is where the mother in me goes, "Oh Lord, no." But Miller had already stood at the brink of death and looked over the edge. Now he was ready to live, really live on his terms and to the greatest extent possible. The problem was no one wanted to try to build a motorcycle for a triple amputee. For years, Miller asked around, and everyone was put off, not only by the challenge of it, how do you run all the controls to just one side of the handlebars, but by the potential liability. What if he hurt himself? What if he hurt someone else? Finally, a young guy named Randy Sloan agreed to do it. Still in his 20s, Sloan was the youngest person at the motorcycle shop where he worked, and was known for being the most sensitive one there, too. He instantly perceived what a special person Miller was. Sloan finished the job in the spring of 2014. Moalem, in the New York Times article, writes that on the day Miller took possession of the bike, a crowd gathered to watch. Sloan had Miller climb on, then Sloan clambered around and under the bike, making final adjustments. Then he stepped back and started quietly to cry. Miller was tearing up under his helmet too, but he didn't drag things out. He started the engine, said thank you, then streaked down the alleyway at the back of the shop. Everyone applauded as they watched him disappear down Valencia Street. Very fast, but with a pronounced, unsettling wobble. It turns out Miller had never ridden a motorcycle before, a fact he failed to mention to the bike shop. Let us pause here and consider this story. Why have I told you, in a sermon called Abundance, a story about a man who loses 3 of his 4 limbs and works in a hospice center? It sounds like a story about loss. We think of abundance as having as much as something as we could possibly want, or even more. If you Google abundance, you'll find religious stories about people who accept Jesus and then the very next day receive a promotion, hallelujah, or give to a televangelist and then win the lottery. You'll find quotes from ancient scriptures that suggest that if you do what God tells you, or at least what people say God tells you, you will have abundant crops and possibly numerous wives and many children. We tend to conflate financial success with abundance. We think if we have financial success, we will have abundance, but they are not the same. Let me tell you, I have known wealthy people who believed they were broke, who had that anxiety despite 6-figure incomes and nice homes. Wealth does not equal abundance. I want to talk about abundance in the spiritual sense, in the way that transcends your bank balance, that transcends your luck in life, that transcends even the number of limbs on your body or the years you are given to live. Abundance is not about having what you want, but about noticing what you have and multiplying it through sharing it, multiplying it through your manner of being in this world. That's what Miller did. He discovered that his injuries caused not just the loss of 3 limbs, but an increase in connection with his mother and with other human beings. He opened his eyes to a path that would allow him to multiply connection, love, kindness, generosity, and growth, and he said yes to the path. Have you noticed people who experience abundance also tend to give abundantly, whether it is of money, love, joy, time, or any other blessing in life? There is a myth of scarcity in our culture. We learn it through language and judgment. Either you're whole or you're broken. Either you're a winner or you're a loser. Either you're white or you're not. That's what racism really comes down to, isn't it? White or not, in or out. Either you're happy or unhappy. Either you're living or you're dying. We're all doing both. Either you're male or you're female. But we know that's not true. We know this kind of binary, either-or scarcity thinking creates sadness within us and division among us. What are you struggling with right now? Health, a relationship, politics, concern for the pain of this world? Could it be possible to experience also a sense of rapture? To cultivate a boundless heart? To find deep meaning and joy in the days you are blessed to live? I invite you to begin by accepting deeply that you are enough, that you have what you need already, within you and around you, that your life is rich with abundance in its own right, that you have more than enough meaning, beauty, love, time, and resources, that you are deciding every day whether to notice them and where to spend them. I chose this sermon for this morning because we have entered a season of celebration. This seems a good time to consider what is real abundance. Is it the gift under the tree or something more? I'd like to invite you to share with us a holiday gift or activity that has special meaning to you. What are you looking forward to in the month ahead? Let's share with each other by calling out a word or two from where you are sitting. Anybody have anything to share about what you're looking forward to in the next holiday season?
Gathering with friends.
Peace.
Simplicity.
Love and friendship.
Caroling.
May all of us know ourselves blessed with all this abundance and more as we enter the season of winter holidays. Will you join me in a spirit of prayer one more time this morning and say the words with me? O source of love and wisdom, source of life, great mystery, help us to see the overflowing abundance of our lives. The abundance of all creation in which we live and are interdependent. Help us to see the abundance of love, generosity, and meaning overflowing in our lives. Help us to transcend our either-or limited scarcity thinking about gender, ability, nationality, culture, and race. To see that there are myriad abundant ways of being and that they are beautiful in their spectacular array. Help us to see that there is enough for ourselves and all people and to live into that truth. May our blessings be multiplied through our sharing them. Amen.